What a great day. It's great to be with you. We've been emphasizing our core values at Westwalt Road over the last few years, and one of those core values is diversity, and that has many aspects to it. I want to zero in on one major facet of that this morning and then begin by reading a fabulous passage from Psalm 71, 17, and 18. Since my youth, God, you have taught me, and to this day I declare your marvelous deeds. Even when I am old and gray, do not forsake me, my God, till I declare your power to the next generation, your mighty acts to all who are to come. God has this plan that life and love and wisdom, and especially knowing him, should be passed along from one generation to another generation. And incidentally, from a biblical point of view, it's not bad to have a little gray in your hair. Proverbs 16:31 says, a gray head is a crown of splendor. So several of us are wearing crowns of splendor this morning. And that's a good thing. Right there in the Bible. But anyway, the idea is that each generation is to devote themselves to the next generation, as Kyle was reminding us a few moments ago. Psalm 79, verse 13 says, from generation to generation, we will proclaim your praise. How do we declare God's power to the next generation? How can we be a multi-generational church? You know, we think that's what eternity is going to be like. How can we be like that? There are a lot of churches in our day that just kind of age and die. It happens gradually, but it happens. All it takes is to go for about 10 to 15 years of not having young adults and young families and children and strong church. Just go about 15 years and all of a sudden it's an old church. And then there's some new churches that spring up where practically everybody is young. Old people really aren't welcome there. They're lacking part of the family. There are not very many churches, I guess, that are flourishing, that are growing, that are authentic, multi-generational communities. But that's who we are and what we want to be. We believe God's calling for the church is to be a family, and a family goes from infancy through old age. Sometimes when churches start talking about families, people who are divorced or childless or widowed or never married feel left out. That's not what we're doing. That's not God's plan. We want to be a family together as a church, and we want to help the families that we are all a part of to be better and stronger and healthier. This morning, we're going to consider three critical moments in the history of families. And the first came a long time ago. I love the way John Ortberg writes about it in one of his books. So I want to share what he says about it, this first critical moment in the history of family. He says, imagine one day God is there with his angels, and God says, I have an idea. I'm going to create the family. And the angel says, what is it? And God says, I'm very excited about this idea. Of course, I'm excited about all my ideas. One of the great things about being God is you just never have a bad idea. But this one's kind of unique. The family is going to be the way that I connect people, just kind of bind them together in love. And it will work like this. Adult people, grown-up people, will sign up to take care of a tiny little stranger. And the angel asks, are they going to be paid? And God says, no, actually, that little stranger is going to cost them a lot of money. Not only that little stranger won't even be able to talk at first. It'll just cry and scream, and you'll have to guess why. It'll make you lose sleep. It'll make messes all the time that you have to clean up. It'll be utterly vulnerable. You have to watch that kid 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then when it's two, that little stranger will be able to say words like no and mine, and it will throw tantrums. And then I'm thinking about inventing puberty. Not too sure about that one yet. But if I do, they'll get these strange things called hormones that will go crazy, odd things that will happen to their bodies. They'll get pimples, their voices will crack, their limbic systems will melt down. Then they'll grow up, and just when they're mature and beautiful and interesting and able to contribute, they will move away. That's my idea. What do you all think? And then you'll just kind of shuffle around, look down at their feet. Finally, one musters the courage to say, "Lord, nobody's going to want that. Who would sign up for that? Why would they do it?" Here's where God gets really excited. This is the cool part. They won't even know why. They'll just look at that little body. They'll look down at those little hands and those little feet, and they'll think that that tiny little stranger is beautiful. Even though he looks like every other baby, and even though all babies look like Winston Churchill, they'll think this baby is beautiful. And then one day, that little stranger will smile just at them, and they'll think they won the lottery. They won't have words to describe it. And one day, that little stranger will say, "Dada," and "Mama," and those little arms and hands will open up, and they'll reach out, and they'll wrap themselves around that neck, and it's going to feel to that grown-up like for the first time now they understand why arms and hands were created. I love the big picture he paints there. We often talk about how marriage was instituted by God and that God created us to live in families. But why? I think if you stop, you think about it, I think it's really all about grace. Grace is at the core. It's fundamental to the universe that God created. Grace is who God is. We sometimes think about grace as if it's just the forgiveness of sin, and of course it includes the forgiveness of sin, but it's way bigger than that. God was gracious before anybody ever sinned. Grace just refers to the generous, self-giving love of God, and that's why he created the family. In God's design, children, the new generation, learn that they are loved and prized and belong before they've ever done a single thing to earn or deserve it. Then grown-ups, God says parents, the old generation, they will learn that when they give, they receive. When they give the most, they receive the most. That giving is the best way to live. They will learn about the kingdom of heaven. That's the beauty of the generations together. It's grace expressed. It's grace incarnate, fleshed out. And that experience gives us language to describe a relationship with our Father, with God. "I'm your Father, you are my daughter, you are my son." 1 John 3, verse 1, "See what great love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God." The Apostle Paul, writing to the church at Ephesus, said, "For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name." And what he's referring to there is the fact that in Greek, he's writing in Greek, that the word for father and the word for family are almost identical. They sound almost exactly the same, the word for father and the word for family. So that's part of what he's referring to. But beyond that, the whole idea of the family is an expression of the character, the love, the grace of God. It's a reflection of who God is. "For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name, comes from, was created to express. I pray that you, being rooted and established and loved," that's the whole idea of what families do, right? Being rooted and established and loved, "that you have the power together with all the Lord's people, all this one great family, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ." That's the first moment in families. And if you want to know why family goes so deep into the heart of every person, no matter how old we are, how together we look, why it evokes and touches longings and hopes and dreams inside of us that no other word does, you start here. The family was God's idea. And it's meant to express, to mirror the ultimate spirituality, the ultimate truth of the universe. The family is not some arbitrary cultural artifact that may come and go someday. The family is not just some biological mechanism that happens to be a handy way to pass on DNA so the gene pool can keep moving along. It is a divinely ordained idea. The family was created by God to be a reflection of His character and the manifestation of His kingdom and the vehicle of grace. That's a family. Never been an idea like that. That was a good moment. But then comes the second moment in families, second critical moment. It happens when the first husband and the first wife in the first family disobey God for the first time and commit the first sin. It's recorded in Genesis chapter 3. But notice its impact on the family, because that's the place they got really devastated by it first. The man and woman eat the forbidden food, and God comes down, He says, "Have you eaten from the tree I commanded you not to eat from?" And the man says, "Yes, I did it. It's my responsibility. I'm so sorry. Put all the heat on me. My mistake." No, that's not what he said. He said, "The woman you put here with me, she gave me the fruit. I ate it." Only one other human being in the whole world, and the man blames her. And you notice he does not even call her by name. He doesn't say, "Eve, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." He says, "The woman." That's what we do in families when things go wrong. You know what that son of yours did today? Your mother. Those are fighting words. Your mother, that woman. She wasn't my idea, God. There's a little subtle blame thing going on, but even more, there's estrangement. There's separation. There's pushing away. The ripping of a family. And I can just imagine what happened later on when Adam and Eve debriefed this conversation together. You think Eve said, "Adam, I admire your courage of pointing out to God where it was all my fault. I gave you the fruit. Thanks so much for telling God all about that." No. Blame, deceit, cowardice, denial, unresolved conflict, they all start there. You ever seen that part in your family? I have in mine. When you read through Genesis, one of the things that strikes you is Genesis is actually a story of families. It's a grand narrative, but it isn't the story you might expect. It's not about great nations or armies or organizations or corporations. It's about families. And it isn't played out on battlefields or in courthouses or palaces or vast expanses of geography. Its sphere is the home. And not just families. We're talking about deeply dysfunctional families here. You remember us talking about the families in Genesis as we talked about them? First, the first brothers, Cain and Abel, don't get along very well. Then there's a murderer named Lamech who comes along and introduces polygamy to the human race. A man named Noah gets drunk and his son sees him disrobe. Noah pronounces a formal curse on his own son. And Noah is called the most righteous man of his generation, setting the bar pretty low. Abraham lies and says that his beautiful wife, Sarah, is really just his sister, because he's afraid that a powerful man will kill him so he can take his wife for his own. So he says to his wife, "That's fine, go ahead. I'll just lie and say you're my sister." He does that not just once, but twice. He has a child with Sarah's maid, and then eventually abandons both the child and the child's mom. His other son, Isaac, and his wife spend their lives playing favorites with their twin sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob, with the help of his mother, deceives his father and cheats his brother out of his father's blessing. The brother ends up spending years trying to kill Jacob. Jacob goes on to marry two women. He has children with both of them and with both of their servants. He favors one of his sons, Joseph, so much that Joseph's brothers want to kill him. They end up selling their own brother into slavery and lying about it and covering it up for years and years and years. Anybody here feel better about your own family? What is going on here? I thought these were supposed to be heroes. No. They're sinful people. And their families bear the fruit of their sin. And it's interesting. The writer of Genesis doesn't try to cover up any of that. Because you see, there's never been a golden age of the family because families are made up of little sinners who grow up to be big sinners. That's what they are. That's what we are. One other thing is through these strange, dysfunctional, messed up, wacko families that God is present and God is working to keep the dream of redemption alive. It was these families that were laid open before us in all their humanity and brokenness through whom God was working his plan and his purpose. The church is not a place for successful, together, healthy families to come together and smugly congratulate ourselves on how well we're doing. It's a place for people and families who've been broken and marred by sin to come and confess our need for God to do what only God can do. Turn our families over to him. It's a place where we recognize that God is God and we are not. I'm not God. You're not God. Our family is not God. A Bible class of 5 and 6 year old kids was acting out the story of creation. The teacher asked a little boy named Michael to stand up on the ladder and shine a flashlight down at the right time and say, "Let there be light." So his role was God. As the teacher was explaining all the rows to the other kids, she felt a tug on her skirt. It was Michael. "Teacher, could you get somebody else to play my role? I'm feeling too silly to be God today." I can just hear that. God is God. I'm not. Wouldn't be a bad thing for all of us, I think, to say every Sunday morning as we're getting dressed for church, "I'm not God." How desperately we need to come to this reality together. Some time back, we talked about the fact that all people and organizations have their stated missions, but they also have their shadow missions. And when we're not on our God-given mission, by default, we slide into the darkness of a shadow mission. Lots of churches, I think, have a shadow mission that you could describe as a successful church for successful people with successful families. A shadow mission. So it's a kind of spiritual discipline, an act of confession today. I want us to do something sort of unusual. I want you to name real family problems. I'm going to name real family problems and then ask you if you're part of a family that has ever wrestled with any of these, if any of these problems that I will name has affected you or your parents or your siblings or your children, your immediate family, if one of them has, just put a little check mark in your mind. Or if you want to take a piece of paper and write a check mark, just make a little check mark in your mind. If you've ever been part of a family where there were children who wrestled with spiritual doubt, who think or thought that maybe there's no God out there at all, or who wrestled with insecurity, peer rejection, low self-esteem, check. Ever been in a family where there were drinking problems? Maybe underage drinking or drug addiction or sexual promiscuity or an unwanted pregnancy or an abortion. Check. Ever been part of a family where angry, bitter words got spoken on a regular basis? Or where mom or dad both felt like vocational or financial failures? Or a family where kids have felt like failures because of their grades? Or where kids who get good grades are plagued by anxiety or depression or stress. A family where people who come to church would have a spouse who shows little or no interest in spiritual things or church. Or a married couple who comes and sits together and looks together but haven't been intimate for months. Or a family that's been torn by divorce. Check. or people who've never been married and wonder if they really belong here, or if this is one of those places where you have to be married to be a real insider, or a family that's been rocked by sexual unfaithfulness or emotional affairs and betrayal. People that carry a secret like sexual addiction or watching internet porn, and the guilt eats at them from the inside, but nobody knows. Parents who feel like a failure because they have a son or a daughter so far from God or so far from them. Check. Sons or daughters who feel like a disappointment because they have a parent that could never please. No matter what they did, it was never enough. Or a childless person who hears parents complaining about their kids in parenting and wonders why God keeps breaking their hearts by not giving them a little life that they could just treasure. And if we're going to be a family together, we have to dethrone the idol of pride and image and appearance. We've got to dethrone it. We've got to acknowledge our brokenness. So today, if you or your parents or your children have been hurt by any of these problems, recognize that. If you can possibly do so, count the number of checks in your mind. Maybe you've lost count. I want to say a word to everybody who's wrestling with these things. Thinking this way, which I think is anybody, everybody. If you feel like you've set a record for brokenness, this is your place. You belong here because we're all there with you. You see, it's pretty much all of us. And that leads to the third moment, the third movement, the critical moment in family history is, you know, first it was God's idea, it's an expression of grace, then there's that horrible moment, this horrible moment when all violence and anger and deceit and betrayal and hurt and woundedness has flowed out of us, which is sin turning away from God's will for his human race. So where's our hope? We all want to know, from where does our hope come? It's the third critical moment in family history. There is hope, and it is found in Jesus. Now, there's a lot of hope and resources for families that are really good, they're great, but there's only one that everything hinges on. Jesus was God, but became human, and he was part of a real family. He was born into a real family with a mother and father and siblings, cousins. Jesus was God, but he became human, part of a real family. And all the struggles that you have when you're a part of a family, Jesus had too. He starts his ministry. His family is not cheering him on. They're looking at how he's hanging out with sinners. He's offending the religious leaders and the respectable people, and they don't like this at all. It's not reflecting well on them. So it says in Mark chapter 3, when his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he's out of his mind. Now look at that little phrase. They want to take charge of Jesus. Maybe they're concerned for his safety. Maybe they're concerned that their family's reputation is getting trashed. People are looking at them kind of weird because of what Jesus is out there doing. So they're going to do an intervention and pull him out of what he's doing. So the people with Jesus tell him that his mother and brother are outside where he's teaching, and Jesus says, who are my mother and brothers? And he looked at those seated in a circle around him. He said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother, my sister, my mother. Jesus is starting a new family. That's what's going on. This is the third critical moment in the history of the family. Jesus is starting a new family. And he's saying all human beings who will love God, anyone who wants to be, they are part of my family. That means they'll become brothers and sisters with each other, and they'll be committed to each other in love, as a family should be. And this will be true spiritually, not just superficially, It's not just that they come occasionally to a service. They become family. And this is true emotionally. This is true relationally. This is true psychologically. This is true financially. This becomes a new reality, a new family. We had to say goodbye to a family member yesterday, Ginger Mitchell. Ginger was not a big deal out in the world. But her loss to us is painful because she was part of our family. She'd been a member here about 50 years. So she's our dear sister. In the ancient world, this all-inclusive family springs into being. There had never been a family like this before that transcended status and gender and background and nationality and age and generation and language and skin color and culture. It transcended all of that, and it really happened. The Acts 2 church springs into being. There had never been anything like it. And there was a single command at the root of it all. All of Jesus' teachings formed this command. He said it's a new command that he was giving us. And he says, my command is this: love one another as I have loved you. Sometimes that love might be confrontational, sometimes painful, always giving. But love one another the way I have loved you. And now you do that for each other. You are brothers. You are sisters. He even said, you are my brothers and my sisters. And the Bible says that we're children of God in a new family. So how are we doing at that? You know, you've never looked into the eyes of a human being for whom Jesus did not die to save. Each one has a precious soul, so every person should always be regarded by every other person as someone of great value, as someone precious. One day Jesus says, I'm going to start a new family. I'm going to welcome everybody into it. Outsiders are especially welcome. One of the most poignant statements, I think, in all the Bible is in Psalm 27. Think about what this means. Some of you know this pain. The psalmist says, though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me. We've been adopted as sons and daughters into God's family, into his household. The Father is still bringing in children and welcoming them, making them a part of his family. And you can join this family today here at Westport Road. You can commit yourself, as Kyle asked us to commit ourselves to the next generation and past generations and our own generation, be committed to each other as a family of faith, a family of God. God's calling us to be a part of his great idea.